Welcome to the Secrets to Mindful Health, where we explore the hidden truths of wellness in all its forms. From physical and mental health to spirituality, join me, your host, Beth Warren, at Nourished by Beth on Instagram and TikTok, registered dietitian for over a decade and single mom of six, as I share my personal journey overcoming challenges towards self-love and wellness. Together with my guests, we will inspire and motivate you to prioritize your well-being and create a life of balance and fulfillment. Let's embark on a transformative journey towards a healthier, happier you. I'm glad you're here. Welcome to another episode of Secrets to Mindful Health. In this episode, we are joined by Joe Moore, the CEO and co-founder of Psychedelics Today, a leading media and education platform dedicated to exploring the rapidly evolving psychedelic landscape. Joe is not only passionate about this transformative field, but also teaches essential skills in digital security, risk mitigation, breathwork, and psychedelic theory and practice. His mission is to help individuals navigate these powerful tools safely and effectively. With decades of experience in technology, consciousness studies, and community building, Joe sparks thoughtful conversations that inspire transformation and growth. He brings a wealth of knowledge to the table, making him a key voice in the discussion around psychedelics and mindful health. You can connect with Joe on Instagram and X at Joe Mo, J-O-M-O-137. Today, we'll dive deep into the world of psychedelics, discussing their potential to enhance mental health, promote personal growth, and encourage mindfulness. So whether you're curious about psychedelics or looking to deepen your understanding of these remarkable tools, this episode is for you. Welcome, Joe.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Me too. I was psyched when I found you on Instagram and then Psychedelics Today. I was like, wow, the breadth and the wealth of knowledge and the variety is humongous. I would love to hear more about what got you into this world of psychedelics. If you want to share your personal story and professionally how you've seen it evolve today.
Yeah. So I was in 2001. I was doing my undergrad in New Hampshire, a small state school, and one of my philosophy professors issued us a book that had stories about LSD psychotherapy, and it was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Those cops told me that LSD was only bad.
Like, right.
What is happening here? Why is there a psychotherapy? And I had some really compelling stories, and then thankfully, my school, university, again, very small state school, I'm kind of amazed this happened at all, had books by that psychiatrist that was doing that research in Soviet-occupied Prague at the time. And just dug into those books, started finding people online, started finding mentorship in the next state over. And at the same time as I'm completing a philosophy degree, I'm effectively doing a whole psychedelic self-study. I couldn't find any psychedelics for whatever reason, but I was spending a lot of time.
I wonder why.
Right. There's actually some interesting, reasons for that, but not for today. But yeah, the idea really just stuck and said, yes, we need to radically improve our capacity to heal people's minds and help them become more familiar with how to use their minds and nervous systems. I started running groups publicly, just trying to get people to talk about things like ayahuasca in Boston, probably as early as 2008. And that was a really fun project. Got to meet a lot of great people there. Later, I think 2011, moved to Boulder, Colorado, and started doing the same thing there. And in Denver, and eventually I realized I wanted to live in the mountains. So now I live up in the mountains of Colorado, which is much nicer for me. And then I started this project, Psychedelics Today. And the idea was just spreading the word about the topic, including the voices of this one psychiatrist who did a lot of this LSD work, Stanislav Grof. And then our teacher, my co-founder Kyle and I have some really beautiful teachers from Vermont, and we wanted to kind of spread their legacy and their mission and values as well. Yeah, that's the rough story. Happy to go deeper if helpful.
It's very interesting, and that's why I'm extra excited that you're on here. You came at it from a research standpoint. Like, you actually got introduced to it in a recognized university setting. You automatically went that route of medical, and it seems that understood it in the way that was something here more than just, like you said, whatever the illegal situation. What would be so helpful now, if you want to just give a brief overview, if someone that never even heard of psychedelics, what can we share with them about its evolution and history, just briefly, so they understand why we're even talking about this?
It seems clear to me that humanity has co-evolved with psychedelics. Psychedelics could be anything from like an ayahuasca to a mushroom to some herbs, sometimes animals, sometimes other things. So it's fascinating. It's a big topic. A lot of people try to make arguments that we're only starting to do like cave paintings because of mushrooms. Debatable. There's another theory called the stoned ape hypothesis, where humans, the brain size in Homo sapiens grew at an alarming rate, far exceeding what we would normally expect in evolution, normal natural selection. And some people suggest that's related to mushrooms. It's still debated. I don't know where to land on that one. But at the very least, we've had drugs and psychoactives and psychedelics for a long period of time. Psychedelic is an interesting term for a class of drug and substance. It breaks down to mean mind manifesting, soul manifesting. Psyche is kind of a complicated Greek word, kind of also like butterfly. So how do we get to experience more of us that's not always present, right? So we can go through our day to day, usually get by fine for most people, some people not so much, but you know, on occasion there's some overwhelm, we don't know what's causing it, and we get a little confused, and there's so much happening behind the scenes. Think of like a movie or a play, just how much is happening backstage to keep the play going. You're kind of like that. Humans are kind of like that. There's a lot happening backstage, and psychedelics can give us access to that. And that's the context in which I approach this stuff. It was a subconscious thing. It's purely like a post-Freudian Jungian thing. And we can work on our material and get better and get mentally well. What I learned over time is that there's actual other things beyond mental health research. Like there's some really great mental health research going on. We're probably going to have these things prescribable real soon from the federal and international level. But other things were happening, like one of the major nonprofits has been working on headache conditions. A headache condition called cluster headaches seems to be helped substantially by LSD acid or mushrooms, and sometimes even like a DMT, which is the kind of active molecule that we kind of think about when we talk about ayahuasca. And then I started seeing stuff about actually healing brain injuries. So people can actually have a bunch of brain damage from war or whatever and heal. And there was a really great recent Stanford study on that around Iboga or Ibogaine, which is a West African, equatorial West Africa plant used by a few different cultures there. And then a friend of mine, Court Wing, he was a trial participant in a treatment-resistant depression study at NYU in the middle of Manhattan, and all his chronic pain went away. Wow. He wasn't there for that. Like, he was there for something very different. And all of a sudden, his body felt a lot better. And I had a parallel story, honestly. I had chronic pain through my 20s and into my 30s in a major way. I could never figure it out. Spent tons of time and money on it. Turns out MDMA and mushrooms at fish shows sorted me out. Like, all my pain was gone. And it was not just the drugs, right? There's a lot that goes into that story. But yeah, that's roughly speaking what we're looking at. We're looking at things. I'll give a list of these substances. Dimethyltryptamine, DMT, that was popularized in a series called The Spirit Molecule. There's a book and a movie about that. LSD, famous for, the 60s. Beatles, Tim Leary, et cetera. CIA's MK Ultra, which was pretty unsuccessful. Mushrooms have been around for ages. They're on every continent. Psychedelic mushrooms are everywhere except on Antarctica, pretty much. So that's really exciting. Then there's, ayahuasca, which is really popular these days. I think even Aaron Rodgers from the NFL is, using this. And that's two different plants mixed together. And you have a really intense psychedelic experience with that, where you might encounter entities or spirits or whatever. But often people come back feeling a lot better. And I have to say that these things are not entirely risk-free. It's kind of why we're here in psychedelics today, is to make sure people have an easier time and they kind of understand the risks going in.
We're going to address the safety and the risks, because I think that's also likely where this all went awry, with it getting its name and whatever that evolved, unfortunately, going the other direction. But, I have so much to say about that. After 5 years of a very deep self-care journey. I got divorced with 6 kids and my whole life unraveled. I had a crazy somatic experience, screaming in pain. And then after all this chronic pain, felt so much better. And I'm curious then, what does this do to your brain? And it brings the whole idea of the mind-body connection and the essences. Like, this opens up the validation of so many therapies, not just this world, the whole idea of somatic therapy, which people would be confused about, or, oh, does that really work? Or even cranial sacral therapy, or all these types of actual therapies that are more about energetic shifts or somatic responses. This brought that to a whole new light, because it's like, oh, wait, we can't deny that anymore. Like, that is something there. I understand now why healing is a verb. So what is happening? Because it's real.
One of the classic features of psychedelics is unpredictability. Even with dose, it's very, very hard to predict outcome. You know, science really likes, you know, this many milligrams of ibuprofen and you get this result, and like, this is how it works throughout the body. The mind is very complicated. We have very few ideas. There's a number of competing theories about like what's happening on the neuroscience level. Let me speak to our kind of more spiritual orientation first. We contain multitudes. It's kind of like a Walt Whitman thing. Like, we contain a lot more than we understand. And then there's that like famous line in Hamlet. It's like, there's far more exists than is dreamed about in your philosophies, O Horatio. Like, there's so much more going on here than we can fathom. And one of the reasons people get really drawn to psychedelics and ayahuasca and mushrooms is these really fantastic spiritual stories. And we're kind of living in an age when we don't have access to that in the same way we used to as a culture, right? Maybe your highlight of the day is you get, you know, the pumpkin spice latte or something. It's a few months out, right? How, if we look back or look at communities who are really spiritual, like that spiritual practice, that spiritual container, and some of those spiritual experiences are the thing that are giving them fuel, as opposed to like a small consumable item for $7 or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do we want to think about that? And psychedelics can connect us back into those currents of experience, so we can have those spiritual experiences sometimes. What are they? Like, it could just be figments of your imagination, or you could be accessing real things, or it could be your subconscious presenting itself in an interesting way. And that's part of what we're doing here, is discovering who are we, what do we contain, and what is our relationship to the rest of the universe. And psychedelics can really help with that. So you can actually go and have big experiences of, I'm going to have like 2 hours of the experience of being a whale, right? Again, unpredictable. This is just stuff that might happen.
Right.
I had communication personally with things that presented like dead ancestors. I had experiences that felt like past life experiences. I don't know what to make of those, honestly. Like, they were helpful experiences at the time. And I'm glad I had them. I just, you know, what was the reality of those things? And how do we slice that up? And I kind of land as, you had the experience, does it matter what the reality is? Unless it's kind of like ruining your life and you're like, all right, let me gamble everything at the track or whatever. Like, that kind of stuff is self-destructive. But like, what stuff is leading us more towards self-inquiry and self-knowledge? And that's a big spiritual thing. So, and some people can have full-on enlightenment states accidentally, right? Through a lot of these things. There's one compound that I won't name here that really reliably triggers a state that's documented really well in Tibetan Buddhism. What do we do with that? You know, now that enlightenment costs like less than $20, you know, at least the experience of enlightenment, which isn't the same as like kind of perpetually being enlightened, as if, like, I don't know if that's a real thing, but, you know, it used to be infinitely expensive. You have to put everything down on the line to get that kind of stuff, if you ever did. And now it's like LSD's $5. Some of this other stuff's $20 or less. That's a really fascinating thing. Okay, so that's kind of like the spiritual talk track. There's a lot that we just don't understand, and contemporary psychology doesn't really capture it all that skillfully. And then there's things like the neuroscience models. There's two kind of major neuroscientists kind of going at it. I'll give the easier one to explain.
Okay.
Go on. The idea is that there's a kind of like conductor in your brain. It's like this control center. And what they call that is the default mode network. So it's like a network of parts of the brain that kind of make up the narrative. The thing you experience in your head is effectively default mode network mediated activity, where you're like, okay, this self-talk, now I have to do this, and that's not clean enough, so let's do this. And then, like, that's the default mode network. Psychedelics often will turn the blood flow down to that center, so there's more kind of like anarchy and less control of what's going on in your brain. And as a result, blood flow will increase in other parts of the brain. And there's all sorts of activity that picks up as a result of that, and very novel experiences pick up as a result of that. And the healing aspect, the healing argument, is kind of like when there's a fresh snow over like a sledding track. Like, you got all these deep grooves all over the sledding hill, right? And then a fresh snow comes over and you can start over. You can put down new patterns easier. We're calling this concept neuroplastic window. Like, a neuroplastic window is one in which your brain is in a more learning state and you can lay down habits more easily. This doesn't happen for everybody, but it, that concept does happen. How it might play out in your life can be very variable though. So you could pick up bad habits too.
Right. Okay. So much there. I wonder if that shift, if that does happen for someone where they could rewire or relayer things, maybe from different reasonings that might have come up during the, what do we call it? Like the trip? Like what do we, what's the,
yeah, is there, the experience.
The experience.
Demystify it often.
That's what I associated when you said it sometimes allows you to make new like footsteps.
Yeah. So like there's two things, like that's kind of the way I would put it, being more psychoanalytic. So you actually like had the experience and you worked through it, and we can do
advanced
that
level, you're saying?
Kind of. Sometimes it gets super confrontational though too, right? Like you have to really struggle and sit with it for a bit. And sometimes that's the thing that gets you to the other side. And yeah, it's not necessarily the case that the experiencer is going to, you know, their experience with ayahuasca is going to feel, oh yes, this is coming from this synapse to that synapse, and therefore this brain network's lit up. Like, that's not how you experience life, right? It's very different from that. So how it could play out is all sorts of ways.
Interesting about this is like everyone's own experience. I guess that's why it's so hard for you as in the science field having such a hard time kind of pinpointing it, but that's also the magic of what it is. It's like, and that's why it's the fuse between spiritual and, you know, medical, we'll call it. It's incredible.
Yeah. Psychologists do not have a mutually agreed upon theory of mind that all licensed psychologists operate from. Pretty much every orthopedic surgeon does. Most dentists do. But like psychiatry, psychology is really difficult. The mind is a really hard thing to understand. I think in part because it's so vast and powerful. And
layered, if there's all these parts of it that are suppressed or hidden or however, the brain is, it really shouldn't even be called a brain. It's not one entity. It's sort of like all these different parts that are awakened or not, or accessible, I guess is the right word.
It's like a Russian nesting doll almost. And like, you can see it in like evolution, right? It's like, here's the reptile brain and here is this new one and here's this other new one.
Right.
And yeah, there's like many brains. And I used to say this line, I kind of like it still. At the very least, we can say that the mind is diffused throughout the body. And from the spiritual, like transpersonal psychology perspective, kind of what I was getting at with those weird spiritual experiences, it starts to look like that mind is beyond the brain. Mind is beyond the body. And these are observations that can come from serious psychedelic inquiry. And we're getting there. Have you heard the telepathy tapes yet?
No.
Check that out. They do a decent job talking about the mind in there with this one researcher, Rupert Sheldrake.
It's very cool. I just wanted to reference that I'm Jewish and in Kabbalistic world, not that I'm well versed in that, but it's all about you as a vessel, like preparing your vessel for like knowledge or for light to come in. And that's why also people have controversy about doing things like this, because it's like a lot of light and you can't hold it. But if you do it correctly, you utilize it to then grow and to, you know, become more of a vessel for more light. You know, some people can't handle it, like you said, and it's just too much. Or I find people do it too often or too quickly, or you just have to, in the end, kind of intuitively trust something happened. And like you said, then go and make this, what's the point of this, right? The point isn't to go back in time and go down that rabbit hole. The point is to learn and grow, self-connect, continue your healing. You were meant to know this for a reason, for today, not back then. I wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of integration, and then understanding that in context of how often are you supposed to do this? You know, do people kind of get like a fix from, is it a fix? Is it a high? Is it an addiction? Is that a different part of the brain and nothing to do with that? Like, how do we do this responsibly and effectively?
with a lot of care and a lot of patience. A lot of people can rush in and say, oh, I want the biggest experience right now. And you're like, wait a second, like maybe that's not what you actually need. And it could not be the best option for you. Like a lot of people will fly to Peru and drink a whole bunch of ayahuasca, and like sleep once and then fly home. Like that's not a really great way to take care of your body. Mm-hmm. Or your psyche. Really, you want to chill, like kind of rest and recover. How often should people be doing this? Rarely, if ever. Psychedelics are not for everybody. Psychedelics, we're getting close to understanding that these things are very great and can fit into our Western healthcare model, which has pros and cons. We have traditional healers that have been at, you know, their lineages have been at this for well over 1,000 years. There's people in the West who have been at this since the 50s, you know, since LSD came around and got really democratized. MDMA, recreationally, people should maximum be doing it 4 times a year. And even then, that's potentially too much. MDMA is very, like, it's not really a typical or classic psychedelic, but it's in the fold. It's used for psychotherapy in research, and it should soon be prescribable. Integration is this big topic. I almost got, you know how like everybody says a word too often, Beth, and you're just like,
oh yeah,
I can't even hear that word. Yeah. And it's, you know, part of it is that not everybody agrees. Like we don't have a mutually agreed upon definition, and that feels a little annoying. How I like to look at it is it's like a set of practices and something you can put into place to make sure you have a better outcome in the long term for your really rare and valuable big experience. So how do you take those insights and make it real? How do you allow whatever happened to your body to heal and to like integrate into your day-to-day life? Like, you know, maybe there was all sorts of energy there and your body did have an adaptation to be able to contain more light, for instance. You know, maybe that's part of it. And so how do you appropriately recover and rest? And what else might be if supportive of that? So things like art and writing and being in community and rest and yoga. And like, honestly, even weightlifting has been really popular for people for integration. Swimming, hot tubs, like there's so many different unique practices. Another way we look at integration is we often rename it meaning making. How do you make meaning of that really strange experience you had that may or may not have felt really magical? And that's another kind of major category and way to look at it.
I love that. Because it's sort of like you want to hold on to the feeling, like you want to make the connections. I associate it with like when you close your eyes lightly and you see things between your eyelids and your eyes. I hope you're not going to think I'm crazy, but maybe people are going to be like, Beth, I think I need to stop listening to your podcast. But I'm telling you, you just allow things to come up more. I guess you could call it more of a third eye idea, but you recognize that there's these things in your life. Like you started off the podcast explaining that you have all these backstage shuffling going on of things happening. You have more of an awareness if you sit with things or gently close your eyes. Like you're able to kind of see the awareness. Like you visualize new things. Memories are like colorful and I see the whole story and I feel like I'm back there. I realized I was having those often or the whole time, kind of like they were very familiar memories, meaning I realized they're probably always my backstage crew over there. And now you kind of like can sit in it in a really nice way. I'm personally a dietitian. I work in private practice and they know on the podcast that I started consulting for mental health patients at this amazing organization, and they also work with addiction, and they all have incredible stories. And one man I was talking with about a memory he had just in context of something he was bringing up, and I just remember sitting with him in that memory a second. Now I'm like, I massage like a feel-good memory. I'm like, oh my, can we just like remember that? Can we sit with it? You have such a presence in yourself that you realize is always there, and it gives you such a new like value and appreciation for things. So I think also maybe integration makes you a little bit like eye rolled. I guess the thing is that people should prepare, what we're saying, for the unknown. So maybe a week off of work or a time when you can rest your body, like whatever you might need might come up. You're kind of there for your body like a child. It's like, what do we need to support ourselves right now?
Is there a perfect like cheesecake for integration?
I don't know. Why do people get okay? Do people get hungry?
Usually because you've fasted, but it's best to come out and just eat some like fruit and tea and stuff like that.
Yeah, everything feels new. So touching back on these misconceptions about psychedelics, so people are still listening to this thinking like, oh my goodness, where did it start running astray and why did it get this whole drug rap to begin with?
Yeah, so it's a long and complicated story. Psychedelics were in kind of part two of the American drug war under Richard Nixon. What was happening was the leadership of America was getting really concerned that they were going to lose to the Soviets in the Cold War. And Vietnam was on. Not everybody was, you know, rah, rah, let's go to Vietnam and fight. There was a huge protest movement, and some elements of the protest movement were regularly using cannabis and psychedelics. And Nixon and his advisors, this is pretty well documented, actually said, okay, well, those people are getting in the way of us winning this war and recruiting more people. We can't make those people illegal, but we can make the things they do illegal. So let's make LSD and cannabis illegal. It went and disempowered groups like real activist groups, like the Yippies, like Abby Hoffman, disempowered the Black Panthers quite a bit. And it also radically disempowered the American hippie movement, which is relatively small at the time. And LSD and Timothy Leary became public enemy number one as a function of how do we get control of our youth again? You know, how do we actually squash rebellion? And this is one of the ways to do it. And it's this new iteration of the drug war. You can hear quotes by I think even Ronald Reagan a couple decades later saying drugs are public enemy number one. Previously it was Timothy Leary as most wanted man in America. And, you know, so it got really political. The science was really good back then for end of life, for trauma, addiction, all sorts of things. And yeah, it's tragic how many people, because of the politicization of psychedelics and drugs generally, how many people had to suffer needlessly as a result of politics.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I don't know if the medication industry would go down or not. I mean, I'm not an expert in that, but I know for sure it probably went up in trying to, I don't even think they really heal the symptoms. They just help people cope with the symptoms, but this is actual healing. Oh, I was feeling stuck, feeling like there was more and more I needed to know, and trying all these energy works and my therapies and everything, and still feeling like something was there that I was missing. I'm still on this journey with it. I love it. I have about 6 journals. I'm not kidding. Oh, so that was another thing you mentioned. I love to write. When I began my whole healing journey 5 years ago, I was scared of writing because I thought it would be like verbal vomit and I would never get up from the couch. I wouldn't stop. And then someone mentioned to write poems. I said, I'm not a poet. And then, well, you'd surprise yourself. So I write poems when I want to see what comes up for me. And then you said drawing. I was like, I'm not, same thing I said with the poems. And that's what pushed me to be open to drawing. I said I wasn't a poet. So when someone mentioned, because I was seeing certain memories and I was having a hard time, because you are in real life and you see things in a sense of memories or whatever you want to call it. And you need to work. You know, you need to be functional. So someone said, try drawing it. And I did. In general, I tell people to be open and curious, but it's really how to walk into things like this safely. Obviously, I do a lot of research, but you never know your type. You know, you have to be open to journaling, you're being open to drawing, and it's very powerful. So if you wanted to share anything about people, let's say they spark something and they're like, oh, I'm curious about it. Where do they learn more? I'm all about, like I said, I'm a dietitian. So it's like, I'm into the medical recognized idea of this. And I'm happy to hear it's becoming more public again, but where can they go to learn more safely and really do their own research and see if this is even right for them. And if it is, who do they go to so they can do this process?
Yeah. Let's acknowledge first that most psychedelics are very illegal and not prescribable. There's a handful of compounds that can be prescribed. Most legal access right now in America is happening inside clinical trials. There's some arguments to be made that churches are legal, though the DEA is somehow the arbiter of if these religions are valid, and you know, the DEA is watching carefully, and it's not necessarily the case that you won't get arrested being part of a church like that. Ketamine-assisted psychotherapy is legal, and you can have those experiences domestically here in the States and internationally. A clinic in New York City that I like, it's kind of expensive. It's called Nushama, but it's beautiful and really well done. Some people are putting retreats on around this. Often people, to get legal access, will have to go to places like Peru, Ecuador, Jamaica for legal mushrooms, or Netherlands for legal truffles. And, you know, that's tough. Colorado is now state level legal to possess mushrooms and a couple other things. And we're similar to Oregon. We have our state regulated access program where you can go through and have experiences. I don't have any recommendations to give right now for places to go, but there's plenty, and just do the research and, you know, do 5x more vetting than you think you need to before
right.
you pick a retreat. And if you're a young, pretty lady, maybe don't go to the Amazon by yourself. You know,
yes.
There's all sorts of functions, you know, and ways to stay safe here. In terms of where do you go to start getting educated, I have two books I like to turn people on to. The first one is by an old school psychedelic researcher, Jim Fadiman. It's called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And then the other one is by a friend that came out in the last year called The Psychedelic Revival, or Psychedelic Revival Toward a New Paradigm of Healing. Sean Lawler is the author of that one. You can hear podcasts of both of those people on my show, Psychedelics Today. We have a free class called 8 Common Mistakes. And we just kind of go over 8 common mistakes, because often people are like, oh, let me buy those mushrooms. And then they eat these mushrooms and then they don't have any planning. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it in the safest way. They might not have any support. You know, they might be the only one in their orbit that knows anything about mushrooms whatsoever. Right. And that's really, risky. So check out my book there, or sorry, my free course there. We have two books, an integration workbook and a trip journal. Those can be really helpful. You can find those on our site or on Amazon. And then finally, make it a team sport. If you have peers, if you have friends to help keep you safe, you can go a lot further. And it can be, you know, a really fulfilling journey. And don't be afraid to say no for a bunch of years in a row. Also, like, you don't need to keep doing these things. And in fact, it's a good idea to space them out.
I absolutely love that. So how can people follow you, listen to you more, also help support you and your work? Because it's really so meaningful. I'm sure it can't be easy. And I'm sure you feel really passionate about it, which is why you're doing it. But how can we help support you? And how can we follow you other than the Instagram?
Yeah, thanks so much for that. And it's certainly, if I didn't care so much about it, I wouldn't be here, right? I'd be
sure. Yeah,
make a whole ton of money in software somewhere. I would suggest people follow us on all the socials that they're engaged with. Psychedelics Today is almost everywhere. Give us a listen on our podcast. Leave us a nice review. That would be amazing. We also have an online community. It's community.psychedelicstoday.com. And we have all sorts of our students and graduates, alumni there, and all sorts of people who have just been longtime supporters there. And it's kind of like our own private Facebook.
I love that.
We teach all sorts of classes. We have a digital security class going on because, obviously, like I was saying, this is an edgy topic. It's not exactly legal. So how do people stay safe? And then we do workshops too. So we do something we're calling transpersonal breath work. It's like psychedelic experience with breathing.
We need a part two.
So we can dig into that for sure at some point. And we're doing that next month in Colorado. So in July in Colorado, and again in September. And you can find everything at Psychedelics Today.
You mean you're doing it in person? Because I think I want to
come. Yeah, it'll be an in-person event Friday through Sunday.
Everyone I end up having on here who I either didn't work with before, I end up working with after. It's like, if I don't sell other people listening, I've literally become the client. I just want people to understand everyone. I had someone, Pinson, doing birth charts. After, I was like, you're reading my chart. I love all this work. And I cut you off, though. The Colorado thing. Sorry, I got very excited.
Oh, so good. So folks will show up like Friday afternoon and you'll be out of there by like kind of early afternoon Sunday. Yeah. And it's 3 hours roughly of time that you have to work through a lot of breathing and experience. And it's a really great way to integrate psychedelic experience.
Is there a time limit on that?
I try not to.
No, I'm saying like, does a psychedelic experience end and you're like, oh, you expired 6 months in and it's not going to come through for you?
Oh, afterglow?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, not really anything that we can say cleanly. Yeah. Sometimes for me, it's a couple days. Sometimes it's a few months. Sometimes I'm actually grumpy after.
Right.
Unearthed something that I have to then work on.
Right. And you're like, oh, shucks. Why'd you come in here? But whatever it is, I'm sure you tap into something. And anyway, the whole point here is that things still stay connected to you or in you in some sense. And potentially that can help bring it back
like
up.
Like a theory that we always push is that you contain the ability to heal yourself. The situation needs to be set such that you can heal yourself. The ER doc is not healing you. The ER doc is setting the conditions in place where your wound can heal. And similarly in psychedelic and breathwork experiences like this, that's the optimal situation, is that your body is doing the healing and it's not necessarily somebody else who's a greater expert than you in what it is to be you. We're the world's foremost expert in us.
Oh, I love that. It's such also a great way to end. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Joe. We definitely need a part two about this transcendent breathwork situation.
Thanks for having me, Beth. I appreciate it.
Don't forget to hit subscribe or follow me on Instagram and TikTok at Nourished by Beth, or listen on Spotify at the Secrets to Mindful Health podcast.